It's time to update your wardrobe with JCPenney. Fall has arrived, and so have a great range of amazing deals to help you express your style this season. Shop for everyone in the family, from suits, trousers, sweaters, denim, jackets, and more. And finish off your look with your favorite makeup and skincare brands at JCPenney Beauty. Shop in-store or online today. JCPenney. Make it count.
By the time you're finished listening to this Pepsi Zero Sugar, you'll be 15 seconds closer to kickoff. Stock up now. Eagles game day is so close, you can almost taste it. Eagles watching. Better with Pepsi.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible. Financial geniuses. Monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary, not available in all states or situations.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Early Modern History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Jeremy Chow of Bucknell University and Shelby Johnson of Oklahoma State to talk about their new edited volume, Unsettling Sexuality, Queer Horizons in the Long 18th Century, out now, like right now, right? Like this week now.
Yeah.
Correct, yes.
Yay! With the University of Delaware Press. Hey, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really excited to be here.
Pleasure to meet you, Yana.
A pleasure to meet the both of you. I'm very excited to talk to you as well. How are you doing today? How's everyone?
We're hanging in there. It's kind of been a busy semester with our work coming out in the middle of an election year, which is always interesting. Yeah. But yeah, we're really excited to be here to talk about our work.
Yes. And we are just getting back from fall break, so I feel moderately rested before finishing up the sprint towards the end of the term. But of course, fall break coincided with the publication of the collection, both in its open access form and its opportunity to be sold as a print book. And so we appreciate this opportunity to chat with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Listeners, note that, as usual, there's the link to buy on the website, but you can also go onto our website and we'll click. There'll be a place where you can click through to the open access site, which is fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much. We're so excited about it because I think this is the first time that either Jeremy or I have had the opportunity to sort of collaborate on an open access site. And what we were really excited about, kind of like that possibility, was that it allowed us and our contributors to gather further resources, resources beyond what we might think of as kind of like the traditional archives available to scholars. So, you know, we could include links to books or other resources, but we could also include websites, sort of like interviews, YouTube videos, and it opened up a lot of possibilities to suggest pathways for readers to engage with the project and also pursue like further research on their own if they're interested.
And I'll just add very briefly to Shelby's point that we were deeply honored that the University of Delaware Press was willing to support this collection as an open access anthology, not only because we're mindful of how costly it is for open access materials to be made available, but also as we discuss in our introduction, the goal of the conversations we hope to instaurate with this collection is really working to de-hierarchize the inaccessibility of the academy, to think about the ways in which we can make this information, this research, our scholarship available to a very wide swath of readers, for example, in the undergraduate classroom or even those that have been teaching for decades now. And so we are honored that this is the first open access collection in a potential series for the University of Delaware Press. And we hope that it is able to be accessible to people not just in North America or the global north as a result.
Yeah, or those, I mean, with academic books, often only people who have academic library access.
True.
I mean, this opens up to anyone. Anyone can read this now, which is wonderful. And, you know, because what are we doing with all of our time to, we think when we produce these works and then no one sees them? Mm-hmm. Now you're like, what is the average price of an academic book in hardcover? It's like well over €100 or $100. Come on.
Right.
Yeah.
I definitely sent the link to the open access version to like my sister and friends of mine who are not academics. And they were really excited that they were able to kind of like engage with the work in this way.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's get to it. First question, though, still actually not quite about the work, but how did you two come to know each other?
Yeah, so it's fantastic. So Shelby and I have now had 5 or more years of collaboration as authors, as co-writers, as friends. And it actually began with an earlier collection that I was working on called 18th Century Environmental Humanities, in which Shelby contributed a beautiful chapter on Phyllis Wheatley Peters. And from that, which actually started right before the pandemic, and then, of course, we know what happens with academic publishing and our lives in pandemic, Shelby and I were able to remain in communication. And following that, Shelby, do you want to talk about our work through ASICS?
Yeah. So Jeremy and I have both been collaborating on projects through the American Society for 18th Century Studies, or ASICS. Which is one of the large academic organizations in our field. We've served as co-chairs of the Queer and Trans Caucus, for instance. And as part of that work, we started having conversations about potentially collaborating on this edited collection. We both felt like there was a lot of exciting work happening in gender and sexuality studies, especially as it was intersecting with work on Indigenous studies, empire and colonialism, and sort of like other questions. And so we worked together to put the CFP for this project together and started receiving submissions and working with Julia, our wonderful editor at the University of Delaware. But we didn't actually meet in person until fairly far into the project. It wasn't until, gosh, I think like 2022 at the first in-person meeting that ASICS held kind of after sort of, I don't want to say post-pandemic, but, you know, post-vaccine, I guess would be the better way to term it. And so, yeah, it's been a really beautiful experience to see how kind of the challenges of pursuing scholarship during COVID allowed us to kind of like cultivate this relationship and to pursue this work together.
So you're both scholars of sexuality.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
And is that how you came? So this was working. Like, what made you think that we needed this book?
So I will say something we noticed in the Learned Society, the American Society for 18th Century Studies, is that given its historical commitments and its populations, its audiences, etc., it has tended to skew to be very Eurocentric in its focus and also very white. This is not distinct only to ASICS. This is distinct, I think, to any Learned Society that we see happening right now. And I think what's really exciting is we find ourselves on a sort of precipice where we are thinking through new ways of doing this research and what it means to do diversity, equity, and inclusive work, especially accessibility work, and how we can invite a new generation of scholars to find a home in these societies that may have previously been hostile to some of these conversations. And so based on a series of panels and roundtables that Shelby and I hosted or participated in, we wanted to organize a series of conversations. We think of this collection as a series of conversations, as an invitation for thinking about broader work that allows us to constellate a series of junior or emerging scholars, those who have found a home through the tenure system, those who are working in adjunct or non-academic positions any longer. One chapter is co-written with an undergraduate advisee. And so this is our way of modeling how we might rethink what academic publishing looks like and invite a wider colloquy of voices, right, to participate in some of these conversations.
Right.
Yeah, I'll just add that I think only three of the contributors are tenured. The majority of contributors in the volume are, as Jeremy mentioned, graduate students on the tenure track or in positions outside the academy.
Oh, yeah, and it is really hard to kind of quantify or explain perhaps to a non-academic audience how much that matters, how much it matters for these young scholars career-wise, as well as for the diversity of opinions and positions you get from people who are not enjoying all the benefits of this system, you know, this very hierarchical system. That, you know, the prize at the end of the road is great, but very, very few people even get on the road anymore, much less
right
all the there. Yeah, and I can't imagine when these scholars that have been around since you got a job when you went ABD, like, what is it, how are they going to interact with this material when we're talking about any kind of marginalized position or identity or the idea of being an adjunct? Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. Okay, so a couple things about the parameters. The first one is the when. What is the long 18th century? When is the long 18th century?
That's such a great question. Obviously, I think that there is a ton of debate in 18th century scholarship about the sort of like whens and chronologies of what it is that we're doing. My position is a little bit more on kind of like the American side, and often sort of like the end point for thinking about the long 18th century is 1830, sort of like during the presidency of Andrew Jackson and the Indian Removal Act. However, there's a lot of debate about what it means that we end early American studies or the long 18th century sort of like with these sort of like moments of legislation that project, I guess, indigenous displacement as kind of like the future that the 19th century is rolling towards. So from my position in kind of American studies, I wanted to use long 18th century rather than a kind of like year end point, like 1830, as a way to introduce some ambiguity or flexibility about how we draw those lines in kind of like history or chronology. So that was sort of like my impetus, but I can also turn this over to Jeremy to talk more about sort of like the European and British end of things too.
I'll just say very briefly that the long 18th century, as one of our contributors, Eugenia Zorowski, details in the coda on longing, essentially, continues to increase. And this is because it sort of takes on this Pac-Man model where you want to include more and more and more into your field of study. And so we often use benchmarks of 1660, so beginning with the Restoration through 1830 or even up to 1838 when Queen Victoria is coronated. There are many scholars who contest this huge, right? What would that be? 170, 180 year time span. And that's because it often engulfs what we think of as the long early modern period, Romanticism, parts of the Victorian period. But I think what our collection attempts to do in terms of identifying what the long 18th century is that we want to think of it as unstable, right? We do not want to sediment two pillars that suggest it begins here, it ends here, not only because this is inauthentic to the teaching we do in the classrooms that we occupy or we find ourselves in, but also because many cultures, especially if we think about the global parameters, are not bound by this type of Gregorian calendar timekeeping. And I think Gina in the coda productively pushes back against how this idea of to be long or of longing for a particular time period is an affective impulse that allows us to think about the placement of our research and what it means to do work in a historical period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. And then, what's the where of this book? And I want you to construe that question as broadly as possible.
Shelby, do you want to start us off or do you want me to take it?
Yeah. I can kind of try to think through this. So I think that the question of the where is an interesting one, both kind of materially in terms of like the actual sort of like spaces and geographies that come up in the essays, but also imaginatively or in terms of fantasy. Of course, we hoped that the collection would be sort of like broadly moving past sort of like the parameters of Great Britain or Europe as the sort of like geographical center point of the collection. And so many of our essays are taking up sort of like spaces beyond what we might think of as a colonial or imperial center. My chapter, for instance, takes up settlement projects in the wake of the American Revolution in Western New York. Other chapters, Ula Klein's chapter is focused on kind of like Afra Behn and her representation of colonial Virginia. Other material takes up the Caribbean. Umberto Garcia's chapter is thinking about kind of like Persian travelers to England. And so that kind of like inversion of sort of like a perspective on a kind of like imperial center. At the same time, though, we're also sort of very aware of the fact that when we think about kind of representations of colonized spaces during the long 18th century, this is a work of fantasy and imagination, and very much of an imperial one. And so Tess Given, for instance, has a really wonderful chapter thinking about kind of the map as a fantasy space that is shaping perspectives on gender, race, and the body in texts like Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe. So when we're thinking about the question of geography, it is very much kind of like both material and this sort of imagined space.
Are you a professional pillow fighter or a 9-to-5 low-cost time travel agent? Or maybe real estate sales on Mars is your profession? It doesn't matter. Whatever it is you do, however complex or intricate, Monday.com can help you organize, orchestrate, and make it more efficient. Monday.com is the one centralized platform for everything work-related. And with Monday.com, work is just easier. Monday.com, for whatever you run. Go to Monday.com to learn more.
Take out, hop in, and save up on Uber One this fall with Verizon. For a limited time, Verizon customers can get 3 free months of Uber One. That means $0 delivery on eligible food, groceries, and more, and 6% Uber One credit earned on eligible rides. It's just another way to save on the subscriptions you love at Verizon.com/Spotify. Subscriptions available at Verizon.com/plusplay. At 3-month promo, subscription auto renews monthly at $9.99 plus taxes unless you cancel. Visit Uber.com/Uber1 for terms.
And I'll add just very briefly, you know, Yana, when you pose it as where writ large, I think what this collection also intends to do is think about where we are in terms of scholarship in gender, queer, trans, and sexuality studies in those that focus on 18th century literary, cultural, or artistic histories. And so this is not meant to be an end-all be-all. As we mentioned before, it's meant to be an invitation for continuing to evolve the work we see ourselves doing through these organizations, through those committed to the intersectional work that we find ourselves doing, but also is a way of taking the temperature of what work is being done now and how we can continue to grow this to be even more expansive, right? More inclusive and even more accessible in terms of thinking through the archive with a capital A and archive with lowercase a, in terms of how we're thinking about the materials we bring into, again, our classrooms or our independent research projects.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking as well that this takes place on the body. This takes place kind of in the mind. This takes place on the page. There are so many locations from which these arguments and upon which these arguments are being made that, it's a really multidimensional work in like kind of all of the ways that my human brain can conceive of. All right. So you have a list very early on of what you want this collection to achieve. Formations of gender performance, decenter Eurocentrism, magnified differential methodologies, decolonized generally, a changed citational praxis, which is just so cool. And it's like, what? You were doing what? So how do you feel about your goals? Like, how do you feel about what has happened here?
Yeah, so I think those of us who study gender and sexuality, especially kind of iterations of queerness or transness in the long 18th century or in the early modern period, we know that this is really difficult work, that often representations of gender nonconformity or sexual sort of like nonconformity are often emerging in the archive at moments in which queer or trans persons are coming under surveillance. So, you know, many of our colleagues kind of like turn to court cases, turn to police archives, turn to sort of like voyeuristic and sensationalized newspaper accounts. And so one of the things that we really wanted to think about through this question of methodology and citation more specifically is how could it be possible to turn to alternative sources of information about gender and sexuality in this period? And I think that opened up possibilities for us and for our contributors to move in a few different directions. Jeremy and I, for instance, felt like it was really important to think about contemporary work, especially by Indigenous artists Norval Morisseau and Kent Mockman, like how they're representing forms of Indigenous embodiment, many of which are kind of like located in sort of reimaginings of the long 18th century or sort of like the early modern period, but how these contemporary reimaginings can offer a pathway for rethinking the archives that are available to us and what we can say about them. So in terms of kind of our citational practice, it was really important for us to cultivate and support our contributors in their efforts to do this as well, in searching out sources, forms of knowledge, and archives that might exist at the periphery of what we might think of as kind of like conventional 18th century studies. I think kind of all of these questions around methodology, citation, what it is we're doing, it really opened, I think, with an effort to rethink our relationships to archives.
And I would say that goals are always aspirational. And so we don't believe that all the chapters we're not interested in a box checking exercise, which is, does chapter 1, 2, and 3 do what we're laying out in the introduction, et cetera. But we are interested in the different contours, the different textures of those modalities, methods, praxis, citational politics that are invoked and evoked by all of our contributors. And I think Shelby's exactly right to identify the periphery as another aspirational goal, not only for how we term the idea of a horizon, right, which we draw from Jose Esteban Munoz and thinking about queer utopian spaces, but also I think, for example, we have a section in the collection that focuses on asexual rhetorics. And so asexual rhetorics are pushing back against this idea of compulsory sexuality as the primary modality by which we understand queer, trans, or sexuality studies. And so M.A. Miller and Ziona Cocker are doing important work by thinking through what has primarily been understood as a peripheral understanding of gender and sexuality studies, especially as it pertains to 18th century archives.
And on some level, changing citational praxis decolonizes, right? Kind of by definition. And I see a lot of, I was thinking through this, it had a lot to do with how interlocking all of this is. And really, like, and the once again, back to the where of this book really allows for a place to hang your aspirations anyway. Mm-hmm. I see that.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, I was just going to briefly add, sorry to interrupt you, Yana, but we open with this epigraph by Sarah Ahmed, whose work has been really inspirational to both of us, right, as a feminist of color scholar who has done important work in a variety of fields. And the quote that we include is, to be part of a collection can be to become a collective. And so this is also part of the goal setting, the praxis orientation of our collection, which is that we want to incorporate voices of people who want to be part of our collective, that are interested in refining, revising what academic scholarship can look like. But also we wanted to note that in our citational politics. So the people that aren't actually contributors, but whose work we are drawing from, we want to include in that collective. And I think that is what we've been able to do really successfully with this, in order to offer different citational models that, as you've said, Yana, work to decolonize who gets cited, how they get cited, and why they circulate in the fields that we work in.
Cool. I think right now would be a good time to just kind of go through what you do in the book and what it looks like. So it's broken down into the four sections, and I thought we might go kind of just take them in order, and you can tell me what happens there, tell our listeners what happens. Great. So gender nonconformity, embodiment, sociality, and politics.
Yeah. So there are three chapters in that section. A chapter by Ulla Klein that focuses on Afroban's play, The Widow Ranter, which takes place in Virginia and represents or uses kind of instances of cross-dressing to reflect on possibilities and foreclosures in terms of identity, gender, and race in the period. And she's specifically interested in thinking about sort of like the performance of gender as it affects both an indigenous figure within the play and the main character, the Widow Ranter. And her work is in a close conversation with my chapter, which is also approaching a kind of pair of figures, the Mohegan minister, Samson Ockham, and the public universal friend, who was a gender nonconforming preacher who gained a lot of notoriety at the end of the 18th century. And they were both involved in settlement projects that were animated in many ways by very different aims. Occam's community, of course, experiencing Indigenous displacement, and the friend working to organize a spiritual kind of like community for non-conforming congregates within their sort of like collection. And I wanted to think about what comes into visibility when we look at or triangulate gender, race, and sexuality through resettlement projects. And then finally, Umberto Garcia has a chapter within this unit that is looking at Persian travelers to England at the beginning of the 19th century, and thinking about kind of how periodical cultures, newspapers are representing these figures in ways that play around with tropes of gender and masculinity and, of course, race in really complicated ways. And so we were thinking about this unit of chapters as one where all of the authors are kind of differently taking up sort of gender nonconformity and embodiment as these sites that open out into larger conversations around empire, colonialism, and race.
All right. Novel intimacies.
So this is a rich section that returns to a genre that is actually most associated with 18th century studies. So within scholarship, the rise of the novel has long been associated with moving from the end of the 17th century to the beginning of the 18th century. And what Ziona Cocker and Kaylee Hall do in their two chapters is really revisit these conversations and also do an exciting trans-historical overview. So for Cocker, the focus, again, as we mentioned before, is on asexual rhetorics, especially in the memoirs of Miss Sidney Biddulph, and also explores how queer friendship has become a larger motif within queer and trans studies writ large. Hall's chapter does exciting work with very contemporarily published novels that are about queer romance, but are set in an 18th century context. And so what I think Kaylee does beautifully is really articulate different stakes of how we understand the archive and the way in which the 18th century is invoked as a way in which we can do continuing queer work.
If it's not impolitic to say Kaylee's chapter is my favorite, I think it's so interesting the way that she's thinking about kind of contemporary romance and sort of like the Regency romance specifically as a site for representing queer life and queer romance.
Yeah, a queer utopia, if we want to talk about queer utopias, right, is this possibility that fiction allows here. That's fascinating, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think her work is really intersecting kind of beautifully with a sort of like cultural fascination with the Regency period through, you know, television shows like Bridgerton, for instance, as well as like continuing adaptations of Austen's novels. This chapter is really sort of like thinking about, you know, it's an interesting approach to the question of chronology, I think, that you were asking earlier. You know, what does it mean to turn to the 18th century, not necessarily through kind of like archives from this period, but contemporary texts that are sort of mediating this period in interesting and new ways?
More on its queer ecologies and cartographies.
We really wanted to include sort of a unit that was thinking really specifically about place and space. Obviously, you know, when we think about the 18th century, we know that it is an era defined by accelerating colonial conquest and the growth of plantation industries, It's a really, I think, difficult historical period to explore for that reason. M.A. Miller and Tess Gibbons' work is thinking about kind of like how these questions of or how representations of colonial mastery over land and territories is resisted or subverted through some of the very kind of like materialities attendant to being within these spaces. So M.A. Miller's work on Granger's The Sugar Cane, which is one of the major sort of like long poems of the period, is identifying some of the ways that sugarcane production, especially as a kind of like asexual mode of reproduction, is not really represented in Granger's text, at least overtly, and that this kind of elision opens up possibilities for thinking about forms of environmental dissent or interruptions or resistance to colonial regimes of mastery that we think of as sort of like dominant with the plantation system. And then Tess's work is really thinking about kind of like maps, map making, cartography as maybe sort of like one of these forms of producing knowledge about place in the 17th and 18th century that, you know, we think of as sort of like so central to that work. But with a text like Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, and there may be no more canonical work in 18th century studies than Robinson Crusoe, these maps are about fictional spaces, and they're engaging in a kind of fantasy project that Tess is really interested in thinking about the connections between sort of like this fantasy project and its projections onto sort of conditions of embodiment, particularly that of Friday in the novel. And so I think it's just really wonderful work thinking about sort of like the intersection between images and kind of like larger systems of gender, race, and sexuality in the period.
This episode is brought to you by Pillsbury Toaster Strudel. Make every morning a memory with Toaster Strudel, a fun, convenient, and sweet part of breakfast. Made with sweet filling, creamy icing, and flaky crust, and prepared in minutes in the toaster, oven, or an air fryer, they're the perfect answer to your on-the-go breakfast needs. Mornings are better together with Toaster Strudel. Pick up Toaster Strudel on your next shopping trip.
Chronic migraine is 15 or more headache days a month, each lasting 4 hours or more.
Botox, onabotulinum toxin A, prevents headaches in adults with chronic migraine. It's not for adults with migraine with 14 or fewer headache days a month. It prevents, on average, 8 to 9 headache days a month versus 6 to 7 for placebo.
Prescription Botox is injected by your doctor. Effects of Botox may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away, as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness can be signs of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Side effects may include allergic reactions, neck and injection site pain, fatigue, and headache. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Don't receive Botox if there's a skin infection. Tell your doctor your medical history, muscle or nerve conditions, including ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis or Lambert-Eaton syndrome, and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects.
Ask your doctor and visit BotoxChronicMigraine.com or call 1-800-44-BOTOX to learn more.
All right. And our last chapter, our last section, racializing affect, queering temporality.
So this last section, which lends itself to The Coda by James Orosky, I think is potentially the most theoretically robust of the chapters, because it is doing, it's exploring critical queer theoretical concepts. So in Noor Afara's chapter that looks at a volume series focused on inmates who are often sex workers, Afara looks through conversations in queer temporality. So what does it mean to explore queer time and the way in which those are associated with racialized sex workers? And so what Afara's work, I think, does brilliantly is invite us to think not just about blackness or brownness as larger constructions of race that are emerging in the period, but also what Afara refers to as beigeness. That is a form of whiteness that is both not connected to whiteness, but is sometimes deeply forged in between a spectrum of whiteness or blackness. And so I think for Afara's work, the idea of what constitutes a racialized sex worker, the histories are set in London, allows us to explore other affects like laziness, work ethic, and the way in which those are associated with racializing constructs. My chapter, which is paired with Afara's, is co-written with one of my former undergraduate advisees, who now works outside of academia. And in that chapter, we explore an epistolary novel, a novel made up of letters, that I regularly teach in my 18th century courses called The Woman of Color. Shelby has done work on The Woman of Color, and there's been a real insurgence of work on the novel, especially to centralize conversations about BIPOC individuals, so that is Black, Indigenous, People of Color individuals in 18th century archives. In that chapter, Riley DeBeck and I focus on how the 18th century novel, especially as it moves towards the beginning of the 19th century, predominantly focuses on happiness as a whitewash notion that is primarily for white heroines. And so Olivia Fairfield, who is the protagonist and primary letter writer in The Woman of Color, is a mixed race woman. Her father is a former enslaver and her mother is a former enslaved woman in Jamaica. And so what we see dynamically represented in the epistolary novel is the way in which the protagonist pushes back against these rather staid and whitewashed notions of happiness that allow us to focus on how affect and happiness writ large can be more robustly articulated and situated based on a particular person's identity. And for this is women of color or mixed race women.
Yeah. And how the novel is sort of thinking about whether or not happiness has to align with sort of like marriage at the end of the novel, which I think is sort of what the Regency sort of like romance typically like proffers. And The Woman of Color does not end with sort of like this conclusion for Olivia, like spoiler alert.
Yes.
It's a really interesting novel that I think is sort of, as Jeremy suggested, doing fascinating things with thinking about sort of like romance, marriage, and other possibilities.
This is a place where I was able to, I have an ongoing fascination with the progress narrative. This is me as an historian speaking, right? And this is a place where I really got to think about progress narratives and what those do and how queering that narrative is important work.
Yeah, and I think that's part of, and we talked about goals and aspirations of this collection, but this idea of finitude or conclusion, we think is inherently antithetical to how we think about queer horizons, not only as a theoretical apparatus, but also in terms of the text that we're navigating in this collection. And so, for example, when we think about The Woman of Color, yes, there is an ending to the novel, but there is a type of open-endingness as it pertains to Olivia's future, her aspirations, her goals, based on lived experiences, that we think is really exciting because it does reject this idea of a happily ever after, which Kaylee Hall in the collection also takes a task as something that is a holdover in contemporary romance literatures that make them highly marketable, right? And also revisit 18th century sort of histories.
What's the next work that you want to see coming out? What do we do next?
I think because the collection just came out on Friday, I'm not quite sure what the next
as he is. But I will say, I know that the contributors here, whether they are working in academia or outside of it, are also continuing some of the scholarship that they contributed to this collection. Shelby is working on another monograph after having just published her first monograph. And I see this as, I don't want to frame it as a calling card necessarily, but I see this as a sort of badge of honor that those, the collective that we've been able to gather, are using as a springboard for thinking about what's next in their scholarly careers, especially as it allows us to continue to diversify what we identified as unsettling sexuality, but even more unsettling 18th century studies and our commitments to queer, trans, and sexuality studies.
Yeah, and we've been in conversation with the University of Delaware, too, that there are kind of like discussions about turning this into a larger series of further edited collections. Obviously, sort of like the goals of this collection are aspirational, and we have high hopes that this work can kind of serve as that springboard for larger conversations, especially given maybe some of the gaps in archives and geographies like in this work. For instance, thinking about how scholars working in Southeast Asia Pacific studies in this period are navigating these questions, how scholars are continuing this work in kind of like broader hemispheric indigenous studies. So there's certainly sort of a multitude of further directions that we could go with the work that we're kind of like collectively engaged with.
Yeah, that is a really unfair question. I'm the weak when it comes out. And I'm thinking I'm also kind of very clumsily getting to this point that the title Unsettling Sexuality, first of all, I read it in my head, despite seeing it and being literate. I read it repeatedly as Unsettling Sexualities, and then I grokked onto, no, that's not what we're doing here. We're unsettling sexuality. And so I'm kind of thinking about like what continues the process of unsettling sexuality, which actually requires me to ask you why you came up with this title, like why this title?
Yeah, so funnily enough, and I'll let Shelby get to more of the sort of like historical provenance of why we came to this title, but when they were first mocking up the cover for our collection, they actually had it labeled as unsettling sexuality. So that was the first proof that we saw. So Yana, you're not the first person to have that sort of title in your mind as a sort of initiative that is part of this collection. But I think the idea of unsettling is, as we articulate in the introduction, is deeply invested in thinking through anti-colonialism, and of course, decolonization. And so unsettling for us is an opportunity to de-link from hegemonic forms of knowledge production, of empire, right? Of how work has always been done per usual. And so the sexuality part, I think, evidences our commitment to thinking through queer, trans, and sexuality studies. And so this is not to necessarily take to task sexuality, but I think what we are instead attempting to do is revisit how sexuality studies has been conducted within our period.
Shelby.
Yeah. But I was really drawn to sort of unsettling more specifically, given kind of like my own positionality as someone who works broadly in early American studies. So thinking about kind of the provenance of settler colonialism to kind of like the structures of lived experience that are emerging in this period. And so what does it mean then to unsettle the settler, unsettle settler parameters of knowing or being? So that was really sort of like how I was thinking specifically about that term.
Right. Yeah. So we continue. I love the idea of this being a series and continuing to kind of ask these questions, including just very simply, you know, what is sexuality and what does that even mean? What what do we mean by that? And on some level, sexuality is a cop-out that doesn't make us think about that, which I was clearly happy to take. Is that great? I've taken up more than enough of your time this morning, and I am so grateful that you got together. We were able to find a time for all three of us. Shelby, very early in your morning.
Yeah.
So we could have a chat. Thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. This was such a fun conversation. We really appreciate it.
And we've been delighted to have this interaction with you, Yana. We appreciate the invitation to talk about this collection. And it came at a really perfect time, right, with the publication of the collection. So thank you again for including us in this conversation.